Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Black athletes and political expression. There's a long history of prominent African-American sports figures speaking out on politics. And one of the latest, of course, is NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick taking a knee to protest police violence. Here's Kaepernick in 2016.
There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
Well, Kaepernick's stance is powerful, but so too has been the pushback against him. Here's President Donald Trump in 2017.
I will tell you, you cannot disrespect our country, our flag, our anthem. You cannot do that.
Well, Howard Bryant joins us now. He's a senior writer at ESPN, and he's out with a new book. It's called The Heritage: Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. Howard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So when you hear that tape, that cut from the president, what's your reaction?
The message that it sends is the most important thing. What it's really saying is you are not allowed to speak. And the racial coding on this is actually as interesting as the question of democracy, which is if you can go after these African-American athletes, the best of the best of the best that this country has to offer in a lot of ways, then what chance does the average citizen have of dissenting?
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you could read us a paragraph from your book, The Heritage, because very early on in the book, you get exactly to this issue here, and I'd love for folks to hear it.
Sure. Trump positioned dissenting views as unpatriotic at best, traitorous at worst, to both the United States in general and the country's armed forces in particular. Black players such as Colin Kaepernick enjoyed wide support from military members and nationwide black police organizations that were committed to eradicating police brutality. But it didn't matter. Sports, if not completely nonpartisan but famously ambivalent to overt political messages, was sending its own message through fans, media, broadcast partners, teams, and leagues. The American flag did not represent ideals. It was supposed to be obeyed.
That's Howard Bryant reading from his new book, The Heritage. Howard, you just said, correct me if I'm wrong, but I want to be sure I heard you correctly. You said that we haven't necessarily been in this place before with sports and politics, that this is something new and different.
The one place where we have been is that sports has always been political in many ways. If sports hadn't been political, we wouldn't have the Olympics. We wouldn't have been playing the national anthem for the last century. But where it is different is, one, the teams themselves never saw a profit in getting involved in this. The teams always figured if you got involved politically, you were going to upset half your fan base, and there was no value in that. Players have always taken political positions, but teams for the most part have backed away from that. The other area where it's become – where it's very, very different in comparison is that teams did get involved periodically. They got involved during wars. World War II, you saw that the players wore patches and the teams got involved. The difference is post 9/11, it hasn't gone away, and that the teams have now embedded sports with the military. They've embedded this political sort of nationalism into sports. In 1991, during the Gulf War, the players wore patches. They had the American flag on their jerseys. And then the year after, when the war was over, all the patches and all those images disappeared.
So what you're saying is that when it comes to nationalism, that version of political expression not only is okay, but it's been fully embraced by professional sports teams.
And commercialized.
But when it comes to Colin Kaepernick taking a knee protesting police violence against black men, obviously he's received pretty much unending pushback.
What it really is it is the collision of post 9/11 sports and the post-Ferguson black athlete. It's about what happened to sports in terms of commercializing patriotism, colliding with this sudden revival of the black athlete as a political figure, which we hadn't seen since Muhammad Ali and Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Bill Russell. We hadn't seen that in 40 years, and suddenly they're back.
Okay. Let's step back in time a little bit here, because you did mention some of the key names, right, in American history. I was about to say sports history, but really we're talking
yes.
about American history.
Absolutely.
Here. In terms of the bracing nature in which these athletes sort of talked about the reality of America as they saw it and experienced it, I just want to play a little bit of tape here. This is Muhammad Ali in 1974 talking about sort of not so much that he was a boxer, but that boxing allowed him,
That's right.
is the thing that allowed him to speak truth to the rest of the country. So here's what he said.
I love my people, and I'm not going to sell them out, make no movies and mislead them and marry blondes because I'm one Negro who the boss let me come in the castle and the rest of them in the fields catching hell. I'm going to the fields and represent them if it means die. So that's why I fight.
And that's one of the things about the heritage that's important. This is an idea of the real – one of the stories that I try to tell in here is the notion of black body over black brain. I make the argument, and I have believed this for a long time, that the African-American athlete is the most influential, the most important black employee in the 20th century. They're the ones who made it. Even if you look at the Harlem Renaissance, or even if you look at post-slavery, where you had an incredible, incredible wealth of African-American intellectuals, they were not allowed to join the mainstream. The people who were allowed to join the mainstream were the athletes. It was the Paul Robesons. Who went to Princeton. It was the Jackie Robinsons who went to UCLA. It was Jackie Robinson who integrated the first major institution, Major League Baseball, before the military integrated. And so when you start looking at the black athlete, and this is the reason why they're important, this is the reason why they speak, is because they were the first black employees to exist in an integrated world. And so that responsibility of black body over black brain was supposed to transition us into that reversal, into a reversal where the black brain eventually was going to be more valued. And what we're seeing here instead is you see a small number of African-American athletes making hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and yet they're separated from the rest of the population.
Yeah. So let's talk about Colin Kaepernick and the political black athlete. How does Kaepernick fit into the long history of political expression from black athletes?
Well, I think it was a surprise. I mean, goodness, if you were born any time after the 1980s or even the 70s for that matter, you're not used to seeing your athletes take a political stance. You're used to your athletes selling sneakers. You're used to your athletes being apolitical and being much more involved in their branding.
I mean, you're pretty critical of Michael Jordan.
Absolutely.
For example.
Well, not just Michael Jordan, but the generation of O.J. Simpson, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, it wiped out what I refer to as the heritage. It completely changed the way that Americans viewed professional athletes. Colin Kaepernick is the symbol of essentially a repudiation of that. But it actually started with LeBron James and Trayvon Martin back in 2012. So right around then, when Trayvon Martin was killed, you had the Miami Heat and LeBron James and Dwayne Wade wearing their hoodies. And all of a sudden, you had Ferguson in 2014 with the St. Louis Rams players getting involved. And all of a sudden, you had a new generation of athletes that were essentially the anti-Michael Jordans. They were in the street and they were using their platform in a way that this generation hasn't seen.
But what's the difference between LeBron James and Colin Kaepernick, right? Because they were both being very outspoken. Mm-hmm. But Colin Kaepernick seems to have received the greatest, not just pushback, but consequences.
Absolutely.
Whereas it doesn't seem to me as if LeBron James has suffered those same kind of consequences.
Well, I think there are two major differences, and they are huge differences. The number one difference is what I refer to in the end of the book as the peacemakers. The Paul Robeson, Jackie Robinson, Bill Russell heritage, they were very clear about who they were advocating for. They were advocating for black people. Today's athlete, because of the money being so great and because of the branding and because of the ubiquity of the athlete, their job is to be the bridge between black and white. They're not always necessarily advocating only for black people. They're advocating for peace. Mm-hmm. Colin Kaepernick is not a peacemaker. Colin Kaepernick has directly stood in the face of the police saying, listen, I'm not going to stand for a flag that allows the police to do this. That's a huge difference. The other difference is the two sports they play.
Yeah.
The National Basketball Association has been very clear that even though they have a rule against kneeling during the national anthem, they have encouraged players and coaches. If you look at the white coaches, Stan Van Gundy, Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, they've all been very outspoken against the president and against the conditions in the country, and so has LeBron James. Whereas the NFL has used its entire power to not just discourage athletes from speaking, but to threaten them and take their careers from them. Mm-hmm. Very, very different dynamic.
Okay. Well, so this gets me back to, the 80s, especially with Michael Jordan, and then later, in the 90s with Tiger Woods, et cetera. Just to be a little contrarian here, Howard, I mean, can't the, dominating success of folks like Jordan and Woods be seen as a political statement in and of itself? Why do they have to become overtly political?
Because people need you. And also, and I agree with you, I think that this notion of a heritage, as I say all the time, it's not a club that you want to join. It's a club where you're needed. And I think that one of the things that's been really difficult, especially when you look at the 80s, when you look at Michael and Tiger, is also the idea that money is supposed to reduce you as an African American in terms of identity, that your salary and your checkbook sort of replaces your identity. When Tiger Woods said he was Cablin Asian and not African American, uh-huh. You think about these things. When people viewed Michael Jordan as transcending race, why is my race something that needs to be transcended? Why must this amputation occur? And I think you're right about another question as well. I talked to Reverend Al Sharpton about this in one of my favorite interviews, where I said to him, to be the contrarian as you were with me, and I said, well, maybe Michael Jordan recognized that at 13% of the population, you're not going to get the seat at the table that you want. In this country, money's as good as it's going to get, and why don't you take as much as they're going to give you? And Sharpton looked at me and he nodded and he said, that's true, but you're still a coward.
Wow. Well, I want to get to sort of the modern embrace of nationalism and professional sports team here in just a second. But before I forget, Howard, I mean, we've been talking exclusively about black male athletes here and political expression. And I just, you know, I want to make the point that we have a lot of black female athletes who have been very forthright in saying how they feel and what they see. I mean, the WNBA
Absolutely.
As a league has been
better than the men.
Has been a lead
and
on
not
this.
Only have they been better than the men, but they've been better than the men in terms of cultivating their white teammates. Where are the white male athletes that have taken a real interest? Chris Long, of formerly the Patriots and now the Philadelphia Eagles, he's one of the few white players who said, I stand with you on this. I'm an American. We're both Americans. We're all Americans. And this is something that is important. You see that with the Minnesota Lynx. You see that with the female athletes in tennis as well, with Venus and Serena, and you see it, the women do it better. They don't get the recognition or the visibility. But, and it's also true when you think of it from a heritage standpoint as well, we give Jackie Robinson all the credit in the world for what he did. But Rachel Robinson has kept that name alive. Rachel Robinson, after Jackie died, she created the Jackie Robinson Foundation. She made sure that Major League Baseball honored him as he should have been honored.
So I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say about this, you know, again, this clash that you talk about between political expression from black athletes versus the embrace of almost militarized nationalism from some of the professional sports teams here. I mean, I feel like haven't we seen nationalism celebrated with professional sports teams since forever?
In ways, absolutely. But 9/11 changed everything. 9/11 is the demarcating line. It's the defining line. For everybody, if you're a sports fan and you were born, say, in 1994, this is all you know. You know the flags and the flyovers and the military celebrations and the police on the field. And this is something that is completely normal to you. And it doesn't seem to matter to the public that the undercurrent of all of this, the underlay of all of this is the money that the Department of Defense is actually paying for this. You go to a game and you think that the New England Patriots are displaying an organic support of military and military families, when the bottom line is that the Patriots were charging the Massachusetts National Guard for these displays, for the flags and the flyovers and the singing of the national anthem and the homecoming celebrations, the surprise homecomings, that this is all paid for. This is all a deception. And I asked people how they felt about this once the report, the paid patriotism report, came out from two Republicans, from John McCain and Jeff Flake of Arizona, when the report came out a few years ago. And a lot of the attitude was twofold. It was, one, we make a distinction between patriotism and politics. Mm-hmm. So this isn't politics anymore anyway. It's patriotism. And the other thing, the distinction that a lot of fans made, was it's a harmless deception, but it's for a good cause. And when I talked to veterans about this, they could not be more offended by this, that you, if it's for a good cause, then there's no reason to deceive the public.
So you don't think it's harmless?
No, I don't believe it's harmless. I believe that not only is it not harmless, I believe it's perpetuating war. You're selling war at the ballpark. I had a wonderful conversation, wonderful because it was so candid, not wonderful because of the subject matter, with the three-star General Russell Honore, who was fantastic with the Katrina cleanup, and he is as much of a citizen as you can find out there in terms of putting his name on the line to do the right things. And I asked him about this, And I said to him, I think I want my kid to be a kid. I don't want my 12-year-old surreptitiously recruited by the Army when we go to a baseball game. And he said to me, well, that's too bad. He says, we need to man the force, and this is a great way to recruit. And if there's some kid who goes to a Dallas Cowboys game and sees an F-14 fly over the stadium, maybe he's going to want to join the Army. Maybe he's going to want to join the Air Force. And we can't get this kind of advertising anywhere else. And so he concluded by saying to me, hang on to those little SOBs as long as you can, because we need them.
I mean, there's so much we could talk about, Howard. I feel like we're barely scratching the surface here. But where, I mean, in this, like you said, this post-9/11, post-Ferguson framework of African-American athletes and professional sports, I mean, where do you see the heritage going?
Where is all of this going? Well, I talked to a Red Sox executive a couple of years ago, and I said, it's been 15 years. Why are we still singing God Bless America at baseball games? And the answer wasn't, well, because we're still fighting two wars, or however many wars we're fighting right now, or because we're in support of the troops. The reason he gave me was, we'll get killed if we're the first one to stop. And that, to me, said that this isn't harmless, that this is a new culture. It's an overlay in terms of how we are selling patriotism and authoritarianism, and we don't necessarily want people to speak in a time when maybe we need more people to speak.
Well, Howard Bryant is senior writer for ESPN, and his latest book is The Heritage: Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. Howard, thank you so very much.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And Howard Bryant will be at the Broadside Bookstore in Northampton on Wednesday. He'll also be at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge next month. We've got lots more information about that at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.